Okay, it looks like we got a quorum. Bring the meeting to order and start out with the roll call.
Cornish.
Here.
Woodard.
Here.
Mullery. Gauthier.
Here.
Grünhagen.
Here.
Hilty.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Kelly. Kiefer.
Here.
Kreisel.
Here.
Leidiger.
Here.
Mariani. McDonald.
Here.
Moran.
Here.
Nornis.
Here.
Slocum. Smith.
Okay, thank you, and do we have a motion to accept the minutes of the 17th of February? Representative Nornis moves the minutes of February 17th. Any additions or corrections from the committee? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion carries. Members, today we have House File 479, Representative Kahn, to start out with, and then we go into a couple of agency budget presentations. Welcome, Representative Kahn, and would you like me to move your bill?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chairman.
The chair would move House File 479 be recommended to pass and move to the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee. Okay, Representative Kahn, go ahead with your presentation of our bill.
Yes. Mr. Chairman and members, this is a very simple bill that was worked out with a lot of cooperation from people in the last session. It was worked out what this does, and it came up because of a court case, and I believe you have in your folders this final Supreme Court decision, which has a practically poetic dissent by Justice Paul Anderson. And I think that's almost one of the best things to read on this. What happened in this bill was that a housewife, and unfortunately the wrong county, Rice County, had what I was calling a bong, but apparently the better legal term is water pipe or water filtration device. In fact, when I called my local dealer, who lives in my neighborhood, and asked, he immediately yelled at me over the phone that they don't sell bongs, they only sell water pipes and filtration devices. So I'll tell members that that's the appropriate term to use. I was also attracted, what happened was that this charge was brought against a woman. Her house was raided because of suspicion of methamphetamine possession. And all they found was a bong that was, water pipe filtration device that was filled with, that still had the water in it. And now most users, apparently, now I only know this from having been told this, usually flush it immediately, dump it, and clean it up. So I was also drawn to this case by needing to defend the sloppy housewife syndrome, in terms of someone who hadn't cleaned it out. We started with something that, and what happened was that they confiscated the bong, and they measured the amount of methamphetamine by measuring the total water in the water pipe filtration device. Now, and I've been in the legislature as we've dealt with drug possession penalties, and one of the major points of our drug possession laws is that we want to distinguish casual users from dealers. And the way we do that is by weight. And so the counting of the weight of something that should have been considered as part of the drug paraphernalia pushed what would have been a misdemeanor into a felony, and one of the things it says, serious cases in the just the expenses in going through the court. This went through a district court, appeals court, and then was finally, the final decision was made by the Supreme Court. And then if the other point is just the effect on the cost of our criminal justice system of taking someone who probably should have been subject to a misdemeanor for a felony. The best example that I've kind of given on it is that I've heard as an example to think of a slightly different case. We also had a lot of help from a professor at Hamlin, Professor Ted Samsel Jones. I didn't ask any of these people to come today because I thought this was that was simple enough. The best example is suppose someone has two sons, twin sons, who are give them an equal amount of marijuana. John plans on smoking it in its original form, and Jim bakes it into a 2-pound brownie. Even though Jim's mixture is less potent, he could be charged with a serious felony, while John would receive a misdemeanor. So we needed this bill to make it easier for our county prosecutors to do their job fairly and effectively. And the bill was worked on. I don't want to say that this is a bill supported by the county County Attorneys Association, but it was seriously worked on to get rid of what they considered the problems of not having to do, of having to do the purity of any kind of a drug charge. The bill, as I said, it was fairly simple. It was passed unanimously by the Senate and 129-2 in the House. And very surprisingly, it was vetoed by Governor Pawlenty, with only a one-line veto message. So we have no, with you know, kind of the cute term that he didn't like watering down our drug laws. This bill also had the distinction of being, I believe, the only Minnesota piece of Minnesota legislation that's ever made it to the Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He did when his first interview with Governor Pawlenty, of all of the things in Governor Pawlenty's legislative career, this was the only one that he chose to talk to him about. And Governor Pawlenty, I wouldn't want to use a strong word, but Governor Pawlenty did somewhat misrepresent his position by saying he was sure that this would only be used in extreme cases. And as I said, the case of the sloppy housewife was clearly not an extreme case. So I hope this was done on the last couple of days of the session, so we didn't have the attempt of a veto override at that time. It was vetoed after the session ended. So I'm hoping to just redo the bill. I don't think there's any opposition.
Members, any questions so far before we bring the testifier up? Did you want to have Mr. King re-testify?
No, I mean, I don't know that we have any.
I think he asked to testify, okay. And he's on okay. Our list. So, Mr. Kingery? You state your name and title and your position on the bill or thoughts.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Kingery. Excuse me, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. And I do want to acknowledge, and quite frankly, and thank Representative Kahn for her work on this bill. It's a dramatic improvement from the bill as introduced. I just want to state for the record, though, that we do oppose the bill and continue to oppose it. It's narrowed dramatically, and I think that's certainly helped in terms of the bill moving forward. You know, one of the things I guess they say in law school is bad cases make bad law, and this was certainly a bad case. And I think one of the primary issues that motivated the prosecutor in this case is there was young children in the area and that could have easily have reached the bong water. It had a Kool-Aid type substance in it, and it could have attracted the kids to drinking it. Also, there was additional drug paraphernalia in the home and other pipes, as well as different baggies and vials around the home. And as Representative Kahn said, I don't think she'd get the good housekeeping seal of approval in the way that she kept her house. We do believe that this does send the wrong message. While the state will maintain that methamphetamine and other controlled substances are illegal, that won't apply to a device if it's 4 ounces or less, contains 4 ounces or less of fluid. Our concern going forward is that drug traffickers could mix meth into water. Methamphetamine is water soluble, transport it to a location, and then evaporate it and sell the remaining meth. With that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would vote for the comments of the association.
Members, any questions? Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure I heard it right. You're opposed to this bill. And I think I heard you say, because it just, it does water down the current criminal justice practices regarding to drugs. I mean, that's, is that true? That it waters down the...
Well, Member Chairman, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, you could use the term watered down, yes, as the governor did last year. But again, this is a, would be a fairly narrow exception to our controlled substance law. And I know Representative Kahn, in addition to working with other stakeholders, did work with the BCA on this issue as well.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, could you respond to some of his concerns about the transfer of, I think you said, meth in water and then evaporating it down and then selling it afterwards? Also with the comments in regards to small children in the area of an illegal drug substance and that they might have access to that. I found his, Executive Director Kingery, testimony compelling in terms of opposing the bill, so I'd like to hear your response.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative
Kahn,
first of all, that's why the amount was put down to 4 ounces, so that we're due, and also contained in a water filtration device. Again, as I say, I don't know a lot about this industry, but that it seems to me that there are lots of problems with illegal drugs. But the thought that anyone would use this as a business practice just doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, just look at the language, you know, look at the language of the bill as to what you would have to do. I think there are far easier ways of hiding and dealing with meth. I don't know that this has ever, something like this has ever been used as a process of doing it. If we want stricter laws for people in the presence of, you know, in houses where there are children, then we should probably pass laws that do this. It's the water is considered dirty water. It's, no one has ever known of anyone who has ever reused it in any way except as something that mitigates the drug and that makes it go in smoother. I'm sorry, I don't know if Mr. Kingery presented this opposition last year. As I said, we worked very extensively. Most of the county attorneys were rather irritated with the one county attorney that did pursue this kind of case, because it gets us totally away from what we want to do with effective drug enforcement. And that was why they made me change that they wanted the bill to be changed from its original one, which really just never considered the total weight of a mixture. They wanted to make it very specific to this kind of case, because they thought it would have no effect on drug, most people thought it would have no effect on drug consumption, and just flies in the face. If you read Justice Anderson's dissent, he says, I conclude the law does not support the result reached by the majority. Remember, we had two courts, trial court case and the appeals court, dismiss the charge. The majority's decision to permit bong water to be used to support a first-degree felony controlled substance charge runs counter to the legislative structure of our drug laws, does not make common sense, and borders on the absurd. The majority reaches its conclusion because it misapplies the plain meaning rule and fails to consider the statutory language in its application to the facts at hand and in the context of the statute as a whole. The result is a decision that has the potential to undermine public confidence in our criminal justice system. He then goes on to talk about the problems with the nation's criminal justice system, which is the United States has by far the nation's highest incarceration rate, with And the cost, as we're looking to cut down costs, you know, this, I don't know what the final result, I did not individually know the woman, and I don't know what the final result of the case was. I think it was kind of plea bargained down, although not, although I think she was still, had a pretty serious charge. But we don't, you know, I think we want to use some common sense in who should go to prison.
Follow-up, Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Just an observation. You know, my initial thought when I looked at the bill was I thought, you know, it seems reasonable to make that change. But then after hearing the opposing testimony and understanding the law of unintended consequences, along with the devious nature and ingenuity of people who traffic drugs, it caused me to pause with caution
for making this change. Anyway, just an observation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All right. Representatives Mullery and Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, Mr. Kingery, can you explain specifically why, and I apologize for being late, but I asked and they said you hadn't answered this question I have. If there's a certain amount of a drug, let's say it's 4 ounces of this drug or whatever, disregard the numbers in the bill, and I add water to it, there's still 4 ounces of that drug. Why can't we, and let's say that if you have over 4 ounces, it's, or 5 ounces, you, it's illegal or something. Let's go away from water. What if a certain amount of a drug is illegal, 4 ounces of, I don't know, heroin, whatever. Or marijuana. And you put that in another substance so that there's still 4 ounces of marijuana and 20 pounds of hay or something like that. Why do you think we should go by the larger amount when there's still the specific same amount of the drug that is less than the amount? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Mr. Kingery?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery. Drugs are rarely sold in their pure state. Anything you buy on the street has been mixed with something. The decision to charge is not a binding decision. That's a decision made by each individual county attorney, and I don't want to second-guess their decision. You're asking a hypothetical question, I understand, but Minnesota is not a pure state, which we think would cause significant problems, and that's why, again, we appreciate Representative Kahn working with us on the bill as originally introduced.
And Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, if I can cover Representative Mullery's question also, that's not covered by the bill. The 4 pounds of hay or whatever it is still, any amount in that is still a mixture and could still be prosecuted. It's not covered at all.
No, Mr. Chair, I understand that, Representative Kahn. I was just asking why.
And that
we're taking into account whatever it's in.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kahn,
that was the reason to amend the original bill. Was the argument that was made that since everything is a mixture, it would be very hard. You'd have an additional burden of proof to before taking a case, and that there are cases where you might not want that. So that's why it was specifically cut down. And remember, Minnesota legislature, the state has made a decision that we treat dealers differently than users. And this was so clearly a case of a user, not a dealer. And the idea that somebody would have a whole enough method, and this barely got taking the 4 ounces of water in the bong, barely got it above the level which I think it's 37.5 grams or something like that. But the thought that any dealer would assemble, and you know, again, I guess I don't know enough about the market to know what the profitability is, but it just seems so ridiculous to even think that that's something that somebody would consider doing.
Representative Gauthier, followed by Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, just a yes or no. But basically, we're talking about utilizing the water as a way to get to a felony status. Okay. I've worked in the field of addictions for 29 years, and I can't honestly say I've ever seen a drug dealer market 4 ounces of water with a drug in it. And I've worked with lots of them. Though it may be a legitimate concern, I just think transportation would be a major issue. And then I just wanted to comment, because Representative Grunhagen brought something up about children, and there are statutes covering neglect and child endangerment in the possession and manufacturing of drugs. So I just wanted to let you know that. I think the bill's clear. It's about dirty water. It's not about containers of water that may or may not have a substance. And quite frankly, I'd be a little worried about buying a half a juice glass of water from somebody.
Mr. Kingery.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, very quickly. And in this case, the woman was charged with child endangerment.
Right. As she should have.
Yeah. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think some of the things I wanted to address have already been asked by Representative Mowry and Representative Gaultier, but I guess I just want to espouse my support for this, because when we look at some very difficult decisions this committee is going to have to make on sex offenders and other felony crimes that we're going to have to put people in prison for, maybe even longer terms, this is the kind of thing that we need to address on a different level. And I do appreciate the fact that this is a very serious case, and child endangerment certainly was an issue, and I'm glad to see that they certainly went after this defendant on that. And also the issues we've talked about with trafficking, I feel comfortable with that because of the changes you made to the language, that drug trafficking, the sale of this product, those kinds of things will still be addressed. This is really narrowing our focus on one particular area. So I do support this bill and appreciate you. I'm in the unfortunate position of supporting you on two issues in the last 2 weeks, no. Representative Kahn, which I'm sure will end up on a campaign brochure somewhere.
No, Mr. Chairman, first of all, anyone who's worried about supporting me on it, you need to stop in my office and look at a framed piece of literature that Representative Knobloch put out in his campaign against Representative Krenke, pointing out one issue that where Representative Krenke and I were the only two, he said the only two members of the House, it was actually the only two members of the legislature voting against a particular crime bill, and actually we were both right. But so it is something to worry about. But you know, when I got such illustrious people as Representative Cornish and Representative Smith to not only just vote for it but co-author the bill, besides remembering the unanimous support of the Senate and the almost unanimous support of the House last time, I don't think it's a real risk.
Representative Creasel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, I do support the bill as well. I just had a question about how 4 fluid ounces came up. If it's a larger bong, then would they be charged with a larger crime?
Representative Creasel, that was one of the points of disagreement between my local bong maker and the members in the county association that I was working with, okay. Was that he... He has a wonderful exhibit. I could have brought them in, but the chair thought it wasn't necessary. He thought you needed a higher level than that. But that was the level that the county attorneys I was talking with would support, so I just went with it.
Okay.
I think it would have covered this case.
Okay, I think we're getting close to moving on the bill. Any more questions? If not, I'll restate the motion to recommend to pass House File 479 and move to the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Okay. Bill passed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Take care.
And thank you for your support.
And let's see. And next in the spotlight is Director Melton of the Post Board. Come on down for a heavy grilling. Director Melton, we've got numerous questions probably to answer you, and we'll see how many of them you cover first so that we don't have to in your presentation. If you'd state your name and title, and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Neil Melton. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training, known as the Post Board, waiting for him to bring up the PowerPoint. And Chair Cornish, I did spend a great deal of time last week putting this together and talking to a lot of different people to get the figures as correct as everybody could do. So I hope it meets your needs.
Right back.
All right, thank you. The Minnesota Post Board is funded by a special revenue fund. I'll explain that a little bit more. You asked for the specific legislative sites. I've got those listed on the handout, 357.021, 171.20, as well as session laws. The fund is from criminal and traffic surcharges and generates about $14 million as of fiscal year 10. From the original language, although the surcharge is now closer to $77, it was originally $25. Of the first 25, 1% automatically goes to the DNR's Game and Fish Fund. 39% is authorized to the Post Board, although we got 29% this year. And 60% goes to the general fund and anything that was not given to the Post Board. Our operating budget. For fiscal year 11, our total budget is $4.5 million. General operating is 1.1, and then there's a reimbursement. Number one is $2.9 million in change. That is, again, a percentage of that money coming from the surcharge, and this is given to local units of government to help them offset training costs for peace officers. There's also a second reimbursement estimated to bring in $400,000 per year, and that is a surcharge on non-DUI-related driver's license reinstatements. So those two fees together are combined at the end of the year and divided out among per officers that meet the criteria and return to local units. Then we've got a $3,000 for board member costs, that's transportation, and $2,000 for credit card fees for our new online licensing system. The chair asked for operating cost breakdowns. Of the money, salary and fringe, of course, is the largest. We have currently 11 full-time employees, $931,000. Office and test site rentals, $100,000. That is, we go around the state and we rent facilities, usually within a college arena, to offer the peace officer exams, and that's done in the metro as well as in greater Minnesota. Repairs and maintenance, basically printing, the exams, the licenses, and so forth. Professional technical services are primarily computer-oriented. Communications, the phones, computers. We have a line that runs from the Post Board on Snellingen University to the Department of Public Safety. That's very expensive. Travel in-state. Aside from the director, we have four staff members who travel quite a bit around the state. We have two standards coordinators, the former peace officers, that travel to do on-site reviews for law enforcement agencies. Agencies are given 10 days notice that we're going to show up. We want to see their training records as well as some of their personnel records for hiring and so forth. We also have a staff member who coordinates the college programs. We have 24 colleges in Minnesota that provide all or part of the professional peace officer education program. These are two-year colleges, four-year colleges, public, private, and recently our first proprietary college, Rasmussen. So we do on-site visits to ensure that they are meeting the learning objectives that are published by the post board and meant for law enforcement training. We also have someone who does the same function with continuing education. Officers are required to have 48 hours of continuing education every 3 years in order to renew their license, and one of our staff members travels around to meet with the providers of this continuing education. It could be first aid, firearms, pursuit driving. It could be a number of courses. And that's about $16,000 a year, mainly travel and a couple of nights in a Motel 6. Travel out of state. No one from my staff, including me, has left the state on official business since 1999, so we do not travel out of state. Supplies, regular supplies, equipment. This was mainly computers that we had to upgrade for testing and licensing equipment. Employee development, this is to get staff out to training, because we have two officers or two staff members who are also retired officers, need to keep their credits up to speed as well as mine. Other operating costs, and I can go through those later. Statewide indirect costs, as well as the Attorney General. Now, the Attorney General is really a moving target, because it really depends on the number of cases that we bring forward against officers for sanctions, number of administrative hearings we may have, if there's ever a rule change involved. This is our bill for legal advice. At all of our committee meetings and board meetings, a representative of the Attorney General's office is present for all of those functions. Training reimbursement. There is, as I mentioned prior, the surcharge reimbursement as well as the special revenue, $400,000 estimated. Reimbursements to cities and counties to offset law enforcement training. Again, the officer, in order to get the reimbursement, has to have been employed for 8 months of that year. The per officer share in 2010, $358, or approximately 15% of actual training costs. Now, every year we ask every chief and sheriff and state agency director, and there are 457 agencies in Minnesota, to submit to us, as specific as possible, all of the costs associated with training. And that could be, in some agencies, overnight travel, per diem. It could be salary to backfill a position if an officer has to go away for training. So we get that huge figure, and our best estimate is that this money that goes back covers about 15%, more for some agencies, less for others. Chair Cornish, you ask a very tough question when you ask for all the indirect costs and chargebacks, because we talk to Minnesota Management Budget, as well as Department of Public Safety. Now, the Minnesota Post Board, by definition, is a small agency. We have fewer than 25 employees. So we are umbrella under another agency. At this time, it's Department of Public Safety. They handle our HR, finance, a number of other administrative functions for us. Asking them, what did we pay? Because we get a monthly bill, and we have to pay these out, and sometimes you don't know exactly what you're paying. But this, and I'm sorry the font is small, the type is small, but the numbers are correct to the best of my knowledge. We got these from DPS Finance. So as you can tell, audits, support, semaphore, which is personnel, maps, purchasing, et cetera, et cetera. You wanted as many years as you could, so that this slide is fiscal year 09. You can see how some of the figures change. Others remain fairly consistent. Again, the Attorney General can be different. Fiscal year 08. I don't want to take up a lot of time going through the minutiae of some of these figures.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't quite understand the indirect cost chargeback figures, what they mean or context. Could somebody explain that to me?
Mr. Parker?
What it is I'm looking at, what it means.
What we asked.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I think the indirect costs mean, you know what, that other agencies are going to have expenses to support the post board. So in other words, the indirect costs are those expenses, and it's going to be for their computer programs, like their the BBS system, their personnel system on the computers, and they get their budgeting services from the Department of Public Safety. So in fact, Dan Boyden is here from Public Safety. He's their financial person, so they're billing the post board for those services and others. Does that explain it?
Mr. Chair, if I could add one thing.
Oh, Director Milton.
On all of these, you'll see a resource recovery. So if you're turning in computers or cell phones, you have to pay that fee. Plant management, materials management, central mail. We have someone from the state that comes and picks up the mail, takes that out. All of these things are paid.
Representative Johnson, any follow-up?
Well, do you understand it, Mr. Chair?
Oh, perfectly, yes.
Yes, sir. not entirely yet, but maybe it'll come to me. What's the chargeback then? Is that the same thing?
Mr. Carter.
We, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we always use indirect costs for that. The chargeback may be just another term, but, you know, maybe we could have somebody from finance if they just want to clarify that.
And Mr. Chair, and I took the phrase, we use indirect costs as well, but I took the phrase chargeback from your letter.
Okay. Could you slide over a little closer towards the microphone there? There we go. Thanks. Okay. Did you want finance? Okay. Would you like? Okay. Okay. Members, any more questions at this point? If not, Director Milton, go ahead.
I'd like to move on to the slide that is labeled carry forward funds. Money not expended during the biennium is transferred into the Peace Officer Training Reimbursement Account and sent out to local units of government. So if we have part of our operating budget that has not been expended during the biennium, that money is then put into the larger fund of training reimbursement and is used to administer or to go back to the local units. Next one, and I'm sorry this is hard. I'm not a PowerPoint expert, but I had a staff member help me with this, so... currently we have 11 full-time employees. There is a post board, 15 members appointed by the governor. I answer to the board. Below the block that is dedicated to me are six professional positions. These are MAPE employees. These are the coordinator positions. Directly below that is a middle management position, supervises the staff in the office. And then we have three clerical support, office, and administrative services. And I'll get to a little bit more detail on that in a moment. Next slide.
Director Milton, yes. Representative Kelly has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to step back, the carry forward funds, how many times, do you have a history, how many times in the last several years has there been money that hasn't been expended that has been sent back?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, every biennium, there may be some. It may be a couple of thousand dollars. It may be $20,000. It depends on how frugal we've been during that year. And if we haven't had a lot of attorney general expenses, because that's the great unknown in our budget is how much we're going to need. So we budget about $25,000 a year, and if we don't use that money, that's the largest part of the carry forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Director Milton, go ahead.
Again, the employee classifications, you requested a breakdown by group. The MAPE, these are coordinator positions. We have six, as described on the front page. These are the education, standards, training, testing, licensing. Three AFSCME clerical support positions, one middle management support staff supervisor, and me. The FTE history I've given you for the last 10 years. In 2001, we had 15 FTE, and we dropped down to 13 for 3 years, 12.5, 12. We had a layoff last year, so we're down to 11. And we don't have any half-time positions on our roster. Again, Mr. Chair, you asked to reiterate the mission statement: to develop, maintain, and enforce selection, education, and licensing standards for peace officers. Currently, we have 457 agencies in the state. That could change because we have some agencies that are small and are merging or consolidating or contracting with the sheriff's department or office. That can change. And as of last week, we had 10,563 full and part-time officers in Minnesota.
Director Milton, could you take just a couple minutes and explain the difference between your agency and the local police department? I've got a person that just hits me with email all the time wanting to turn the post board into taking individual complaints from about officers all over the state, you know, everything from minor to major. Explain the difference between what you actually investigate and have control over as far as investigations and peace officers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are a regulatory board. We are not the statewide internal affairs unit. When POST was passed in legislation in 1977 and began operations in 1978, it was very clear that the role of investigation and resolutions of allegations of misconduct will rest primarily upon the chief, sheriff, or state agency director. They wanted it handled at the local level. Where the POST board gets involved, normally, are criminal convictions. It was established, and Minnesota was the first state in the nation to do this, that you may work for Minneapolis or the State Patrol or DNR, but the state holds your license and has purview over that license. So if you violate certain criminal codes, certain traffic codes, depending on what it is, the post board has sanctioning authority to suspend or revoke that license. But for the most part, allegations of misconduct about an officer's behavior, attitude, and so forth must be directed back to the agency to be investigated.
And the levels of that you can actually remove a license, the criteria for Mr. Melton are like what, theft and felonies, and what categories where an officer's license can be revoked by the post board?
Mr. Chair, members, a felony is an automatic revocation. Gross misdemeanors, the complaint committee has authority to investigate and look at that. Theft in any amount, assault, or drugs.
Representative Moore.
Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Melton, what I'm trying to think of is there's a lot of parts of our civil code that if you violate them, even though it doesn't say so, it's a misdemeanor. What about those? You talked about the criminal code, but they're not in the criminal code. They're in other parts of the statutes. But a violation by law is a misdemeanor. What can that also come up?
Director Milton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, we do not have sanctioning authority over misdemeanor convictions unless it is theft, assault, or some sort of a drug violation. Other than that, misdemeanors are held or sanctioned at the local level.
Okay. Questions? Otherwise, do you have another slide, or is it?
You talked about agency goals. Now, in the agency profile that was put out in the budget book, you've seen a long one. But I wanted to emphasize one of the things that POST is working on for the following year or years, and this is my task. This is to continue to work with the Office of Enterprise Technology on the online web-based licensing and services to our stakeholders. For students who want to apply to take the peace officer exam, officers who want to renew their licenses and so forth. And this has been quite a long process. We've been in this for 2.5 years. We're getting there. That it was the Post Board and Emergency Medical Services Board that were the two pilot projects to go forward. And it has not been without some problems, but we're working through them. So I want to continue to increase efficiencies, decrease costs, because we spend way too much money on mailing, and improve customer services. Because with our newer, younger students coming out, they demand that they be able to do most of their functions online. And we are trying, working with OET, to get that service available.
Representative Monterey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Melton, if we're looking at reductions, I guess I'm not sure what would affect the actual training, because that's a concern of mine, is not getting the proper training to police that's needed. And certain things, I think you mentioned before that there's a use of force they have to go through every year or something like that. I'm very concerned about certain other types of training, and I don't happen to buy into the ones that believe that, for instance, the mentally ill training, the ones with disabilities, so that the police officers know how to respond to somebody that's in a difficult mental state. And I know that happens to be what both the president and the top two officers in Minneapolis Police Federation tell me is possibly the best training that can be given to cops in this state and the most needed. And they're right on the line all the time because they see everything in Minneapolis. So the last thing I want to see is certain programs cut. I'd like to see that one added maybe instead of something. And there's a couple others I think are needed according to cops. How does a reduction in the budget affect those things?
Director Milton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulroy. First, let me make a statement that HOST, as a regulatory agency, we do not provide training. We approve training. So then we look at what's required by the state. Currently, the legislature has mandated two training areas for peace officers. One is use of force, and that's all the way from empty hand techniques to verbal presence to use of force, firearm. And the second category is pursuits and emergency vehicle operations. Every officer in the state is required to have that training. Other topics, such as you mentioned, working with the mentally ill, is left up to the local unit of government. If they have the money and if they see the need to provide that training, they will do so. But it is not a mandate. I tell you, Representative Mulroy, it runs a gamut across the state. The types of training and the topics, and we've got some agencies that are using their money to Spanish for law enforcement. There's a number of different things, and it's left up to the local unit of government to decide what their needs are and how to balance out the priority of those limited training dollars. If they have to do use of force, they have to do pursuits, what do we have left over? So if there's a reduction, it may go to reduce training in those nice but not required areas.
Mr.
Representative Monroy.
So if we reduce the money, it wouldn't reduce the money going to the every year force issue training. It would go to the extra that aren't required. Is that what you're saying?
Director Milton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulroy, the money that goes back to Minneapolis PD, they're going to get $358 per officer. Now, Chief Dolan and his staff can determine what is absolutely required. Well, the state tells them what's required. Number one, use of force, and pursuits and emergency vehicle operation. There's money left over in their training budget, whether they use our reimbursement or a line item from the city of Minneapolis. It is up to the city of Minneapolis Police Department to determine what they're going to train.
Mr. Chairman, I want to hold it up. I'll ask them more details.
Well, first, Representative Mulroy and members, for some clarification on that, it's a good question that Representative Mulroy is asking, because to give you an idea, if a police agency sends its officers to pursuit training, if you don't use your own cars, they charge you $350 a crack to use theirs, and if you use your own, there's a good chance you're going to take out the brakes. It's just really rough on the car, a lot of wear and tear. Then you have the officer's salary, then somebody covering from the officer while they're gone, the overtime or whatever it takes to fill that shift while that officer is in training, and then if you send somebody, the other one is range training, use of force. Which amounts to a range training. A lot of the small departments have to pay $100 per officer to a range depending on who wants the premium, they can get with the county or get lucky enough to put in with another city. Or so the agencies right now are scrambling to try to get as much stuff as they can free, because the 358 doesn't go very far. So. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Melton, mine is more of a general question. And during my campaign, I talked to a city police officer and then also a county sheriff and her deputy, and both of them seemed to echo the same thing. They said there seemed, in their opinion, when I asked them about where to save money, there seemed to be a lot of overlap between the state patrol, sheriff's departments, and city police departments in some areas. And is there any agency or standard, you know, that decides or recommends to counties, or maybe it's just a county decision, where you have, you know, some cities will rent or pay a fee to have a sheriff's department patrol their city, other cities will have their own police department. And if there's, you know, in my observation, it seems to be a patchwork network out there. It doesn't seem like there's a plan or recommendation. Do you work with any other agencies as far as looking at that across the state? And again, both of these particular officers suggest that there would be major savings because of the overlap of coverage in those areas.
Director Melton, yeah, I think you had some figures about how many actual departments had disbanded or disorganized or unorganized in the last year or two or something at one point, didn't you?
Mr. Chair and Representative, since 1990, we've had 131 agencies disband. Now, they may have consolidated, contracted with the Sheriff's Department, or simply gone out of business. That's not our decision. If you choose to have a police department in the state of Minnesota, you have to abide by certain rules and regulations and standards. If you choose not to, that's your decision. Now, there's not 2 weeks that go by that I don't get a call from an elected official from some community in Minnesota, and they're wondering what they should do, because the costs are high. I can't give them the answer, but I can give them a list of questions they should ask, and they need to ask that among themselves at a council or township meeting, talk to their community, and figure out what the answers are. Once they get the answers to those questions, then they'll know what to do. But we can't compel or try to coerce agencies into disbanding or consolidating. However, we've seen in the state that there is overlap. Certainly, the county has jurisdiction over all the townships there, and the state patrol has jurisdiction over the entire state. And some places in the state patrol is off the road after 2 o'clock in the morning, so there isn't state patrol coverage in the early wee hours of the morning. But that is a decision of local control.
Representative Grunhagen, follow up?
That basically was it. It's more or less the local officials contact the contact yourself or somebody up here at the state asking questions, and you give them a list of on whether they should, you know, they're overstaffed, understaffed, or whatever. You basically saying you give them a list of questions to ask. But there's, so basically it's just local control decision on all that.
Director Milton?
Mr. Chair, if I can follow up on that. One of the questions I get from small towns is, we want to have an officer 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. What's that going to cost us? And I said, well, that's going to cost 7 employees. It takes 7 employees to give you 24-hour coverage, 7 days a week, 365 days of the year, because of time off and vacations and sick times and training. So all of a sudden, that 7 FTE figure gets their attention. Well, we can't afford that. So in Minnesota, of these 457 agencies, we've probably got 20% may have one employee. They have one employee, and they work as needed. We have a couple of officers in the state that refer to themselves as, well, we're the dance cop. They work Friday and Saturday nights. And if they have other events that are going on, they may hire agents or officers from local communities to help them out on a part-time basis.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in your professional opinion, do you believe there is a lot of overlap over the state? And is there any way to incentivize some consolidation in that area by the state? Or is that, I don't want to mandate, but I mean incentivize where we can eliminate some of that excessive cost?
Director Melton.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, my opinion, there is overlap, but it's not undue overlap because we have joint jurisdiction. So you're automatically going to have sheriff's cars driving down the same street as a police officer who's being followed by a trooper. They can all be on the same road at the same time. And if you're in certain parts of the state, there'll also be a tribal police car in the line. So if you're driving down and you're speeding, there are four different agencies that could cite you for that violation, yet they all have legal jurisdiction over that stretch of highway. Now, Mr. Chair, when I started years ago, I traveled the state. I wanted to talk to as many people as I possibly could. And it was interesting to look at the parallels from 20 years ago about regionalization of public services, you know, with schools and hospitals and newspapers and so forth. It was apparent nobody really cares what's written on the side of the truck that plows their snow. It can be anything. It could be a private vendor. They don't care. But there is something about Americana. There's something about wanting to see your agency's or your city's name painted on the trunk lid or the fender of that car. And that's why you've got Orono Police Department. There's like six different agencies they subcontract with. And every one of those, Long Lake and Minnetonka Beach and Navarre and all the others, they want their name listed there. That's what they want. And I think they've made those decisions based on long discussions. And other agencies say, we can't do it anymore. We're going to rely on the sheriff's office to handle all of our calls. We can't tell them what to do. We can just ask them or give them the questions they should consider.
Representative Gruenhagen? Yeah, and just for some clarification on that, it's totally the local city, I think, prerogative whether they have a police department or not. The problem is if they disband their police department, the sheriff usually tells them, I'm only going to answer 911 calls, emergency. You're going to have to chase your own dogs and take care of your own litter and this and that. He's only going to answer emergency calls. And for example, in Janesville, a little community of 2,500 in our one of my counties, they want to disband their police department of like three or four officers, and they asked the sheriff to come in, and he came to the council meeting and gave them a contract price to cover it with the same price as they were paying, so there was no savings. So they're trying to figure out whether they want a police department. They know if they give it up, it's going to be a 20-minute response, and a lot of the things that they want done aren't going to get done, but that's their local decision. So, Director Melton, do you have any more?
Well, the next few slides, these were tough. You asked me for budget reduction options, 5, 10, 15, and 20. This was a struggle. 5%, and this was divided between our operating budget and our reimbursement. 5% in both cost codes. One staff layoff is likely because we do not have a 0.5 as was listed in the governor's recs. Per officer reimbursement, as Representative Mulberry asked earlier, would go from $358 to approximately $340. Would result in fewer law enforcement agency visits, college, and continuing education site visits. 10% reduction, certainly that's a staff person gone. Reimbursement drops from $358 to $322, and again, fewer site visits. Now, we're required by statute to visit 10% of law enforcement agencies every year. So that's roughly 50 agencies a year divided between two staff members, although I pick up a few of those myself just to stay in that mind frame to go out and visit the chiefs and sheriffs. Now we get worse yet. 15% would be two staff layoffs are likely. Reduction in reimbursement from $358 to $304. 20%. Certainly two staff layoffs, reimbursement from $358 to $286, and the visits to colleges, agencies, and CE providers. The last, you asked some questions about a vehicle. Post has always had one vehicle, driven primarily by me, but it's available to other staff members as they go to these site visits or meetings and so forth. We just sort of work it out. Rulemaking, there's nothing currently in the works for that. And lawsuits, fortunately none pending at this time. Any questions, Mr. Chair?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have a question about per officer reimbursements. Now, if the per officer reimbursement was reduced, let's say, to 286, would that result in the officer getting less reimbursement or also the possibility or likelihood of less training occurring for the officer, or a combination of the two of those?
Mr. Chair?
Director Milton.
That's a very good question. Thank you for that one. The money is sent back to the agency. It's not sent to the officer. So once we've determined what the pot of money is and the number of eligible shares, an electronic transfer is made to that local unit of government. Now, the government can put it in their city coffers or the police department's coffers. Again, that's their decision. But once the chief figures out, this is how much I'm getting back for my officers, $358 last year. All right? I've got to give them use of force training. I've got to rent a range, get the ammunition. I've got to drive them some distance. And I've got to give them use of force and pursuits. I've got to do that. What's left over? They have no choice. They have to fund use of force training. They have to do that shooting. They have to do the emergency vehicle operations. And by law, that's 8 hours. It's 4 hours of a classroom, 4 hours behind the wheel. They have to do that. So whatever is left over is thrust upon the shoulders of that chief or sheriff or state agency director. And they all make different decisions.
Representative Johnson, good question. We might want to get a couple of chiefs in here and ask them if they, how far that money goes and how they're spending it, to get an idea how much, you know, goes to actually a lack of training, or if it fulfills the requirement for the mandated training. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Melton, I was just curious on a couple of calculations on when we're looking at the per officer reimbursement. Of course, that's your largest fund. How many officers in that? I from my calculations, about 9,500.
Director
Mr.
Milton.
Chair, Representative, yes, last year there was 9,130 some officers eligible for that share. That means they had been employed 8 months.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelly.
And then what number do you attach to that staff layoff?
Director Milton.
Could you explain that?
Just excuse me, Mr. Chair, just when you're looking at the reduction amount, I guess my point being, when you spread out that per officer reimbursement, how much would that decrease if you actually kept the staff to do what you need to do? Would it go down by $5, $6 on that reimbursement side?
Director Milton. Chair, Representative, the instructions given to me, that if we have 5% coming out of our operating budget, that would mean $57,000 out of our operating budget. That's a person. $143,000 is 5% of the reimbursement. So we looked at, or I looked at that as two different decisions. One is our operating budget, because the reimbursement is passed through money. We simply hold that and then give it back to local units of government. So the money from a staff person, if we lose $57,000, right, that's a staff person gone. There may be savings that would be at the end of a biennium transfer to reimbursement, but it's far too early to tell what these figures are going to be.
Okay. Director Milton, could you address the governor's change items in his budget concerning your agency?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, that's the 5% across the board, and to be divided up by our two major cost codes. Personnel, $57,000, that's a person. And the governor's recs mentioned an anticipated reduction of 0.5 FTE. We don't have a 0.5 FTE person, and we can't lay off half a person. That's a full position. And the reimbursement would be reduced by $143,000, as reflected in the 5% cut from 358 to 343.
Hey, members, are you done with your presentation, Director Milton?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
You want any closing comments or anything? Or?
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you very much for this opportunity. I know you're facing very, very difficult times. This is dire. And the Post Board, although no one wants to have their budgets reduced, we understand we're part of a larger society, a larger picture. I'm hoping somewhere we find the money. we are not reducing my agency's mission. There are no jobs we no longer do. We may not do it as efficiently or as quickly. We'll get it done. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. I think Representative Hilty had a question yet. I'm sorry.
I do, Mr. Chair. actually, maybe a two-part question, but Director Melton, if the Post Board is funded by a surcharge on criminal and traffic convictions, is there any discernible trend in how much that generates, how much that has generated over the past few years?
Director Melton?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, the same $25, although the surcharge grows, we can only focus on the original $25 surcharge that was allocated, that was part of the enabling legislation for the Post. It goes back to 1998-99 when it was consolidated. The pot of money has gone down. For a while, that $25 surcharge generated almost $16 million per year. We're down to $14 million. So fewer tickets being written, people are driving better, officers are giving more warnings. I don't know, but the fund has shrunk by nearly $2 million.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Hilty had a follow-up.
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Melton or Mr. Carter, what is the total of the surcharge? If it's the first $25 that we're talking about here, what is the actual?
75 or 77, what is it now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, it is, I believe, if I remember right, $75, or if you're in Ramsey County, it is $76.
And Mr. Chair, if the 39% that goes to the Post Board were reduced, would we assume that that reduction would just result in that amount going to the general fund instead?
Mr. Carter, isn't it we built some of that money out of the VAT fund that was headed for the Post Board to balance the budget? Do you mean the general fund?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty, any savings that would be taken from the Post Board would go to the general fund, and in the long run it would help our target.
Thank you.
The surcharge has long been a point of discussion. We raised it up a couple of different times. We got to the point where we believed that officers were reluctant to write tickets because the basic in my county, the minimum speeding is up to $134 now for a fine. And so if we raise the surcharge, then and that goes up. And then also another reason for the reduction in our funding for the surcharges might be because a lot more departments are using administrative fines that we enacted a couple of years ago. In fact, one town in my area has changed massive amounts of things over to administrative fines. The problem with the administrative fines is that the way we set the law up is if your reading is 9 miles an hour or under, it turns into administrative fine instead of a criminal where we would get the surcharge, the full surcharge. Now in the administrative fine, and there's a number of police departments that are telling their officers that as the speed goes down in the radar, don't lock it in until it hits 9 miles per hour or less, because then they keep the majority of the money, or a lot bigger portion they would have if it was a criminal surcharge. So there are ways to get around even the best laws that we try to craft here. Oh, no, that wouldn't. But
sounds like that's consumer friendly.
Representative Mulroy.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, that was just what I was going to say, that you, the chair, was extremely involved in that whole issue of administrative fines, and I remember it being in my committee, and the chair took a pretty strong position on it, as I recall, and you brought that out.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Melton, just clarify one thing. I understand what your directive was from the 5% level, but in your opinion, would it be more disruptive to take, as I calculate that out, it'd be about a $6 reduction as opposed to taking a staff person to the reimbursement fund? It'd be about a $6 reduction. So in your opinion, would it be more detrimental to take a staff person at the Post Board or pass that along to the to the reimbursement.
Director Milton.
Mr. Chair, Representative, looking out for my agency, I want to keep my staff. We're down from 15 FTE to 11. Now, the chiefs and sheriffs would not agree. They'd say, we want our reimbursement money. So you're going to get a different answer depending on who you talk to. So I am looking out for my staff. I know we aren't reducing any workload, and I would prefer to maintain a staff member and be able to provide the regulatory and resource services that the Post Board is known for. But I understand on the opposite end of that spectrum, the chiefs and sheriffs are going to say this is money coming out of our training budget, and they're not going to want to lose any money.
Thank you. Well, Director Milton, thank you for that blunt, direct answer. We are not accustomed to that usually. It is good to hear. Other members with questions? I can gather from the amount we've grilled your agency, which is small in comparison to the Department of Corrections, we're going to probably have to put an extra day in on them. So it gives you an idea, committee members, how tight we are with money when we spend this amount of time and asking this many questions, so trying to unearth every dime we can. Thank you, Director, very much for your testimony. It's good to see you again. Okay, members, we're going to hear from, Director Ullman, I pronounced that right? All right, please come up and were you able to address all our concerns and questions the way we put them out to you? Go ahead and state your name and title and begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Marie Ullman. I'm the Executive Director of the Private Detective and Protective Agent Services Board. Glad to have the opportunity this morning to visit with you a little bit about an overview of our agency for those of you who are new to service here at the legislature, as well as refresh some folks that may not be as familiar with our small, wee little agency. I have with me this morning Dan Boynton, who assists our agency from the Department of Public Safety, from their Finance and Fiscal and Administrative Services area. And just as a brief overview, the Private Detective and Protective Agent Services Board is a fee-driven agency. With our fees and any penalties that are imposed by the board are deposited directly into the general fund from which we receive an appropriation from the legislature. We have five board members that participate in monthly meetings of business of licensing, license reissuances, and issues of training, as well as other matters. We have two public members that sit on the board. We have one licensed protective agent and one licensed private detective, as well as the superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. As I mentioned, the board meets on a monthly basis, and they interview candidates for new licenses in both the protective agent and private detective area. They review applications for license reissuance, which occurs for a license holder every 2 years. And they also review training proposals for agencies or training providers that are interested in providing training to our license holders. The board judiciously reviews those new candidates for licensure to make sure that there's compliance with statutory requirements. And in reviewing the license reissuance candidates, there is an administrative audit process that goes on as they report things that have occurred in their business for the last couple of years during their license period, including reporting on their training compliance. The board has nearly 300 license holders in both the private detective and protective agent area. We also manage roughly 80 training providers that represent a little over 750 training courses that we approve and manage and renew on a biannual basis. The board has engaged the license holder community to solicit their input involved in the training review process so that they have the opportunity to share their expertise and backgrounds in the training area and what's important to the profession. Some of the service areas that are represented by some of our license holders and the services that they provide are uniform guard and patrol services, armored car services, event security, executive protection, corporate investigations, pre-employment and employment investigations, insurance fraud. They also have become very much visible in our communities in regards to the public being very aware of our license holders, such as shopping malls, business office complex, airports, government buildings, and nuclear power plants. They also have an impact in regards to things that go on for corporations and other businesses regarding fraud and theft that obviously have a very large impact on our economy. There are several thousand employees that are employed by our license holders for which we monitor things like completion of criminal history record checks, the issuance of identification that links that employee back to the employer, which is our license holder, and their compliance with training. These services are a key support to public safety efforts. So they're very much, as I mentioned, in the communities. People in the community see these individuals in places that they're going to on a daily basis and count on those people for some assistance when trouble might occur. The ratio of private security, for example, personnel to public law enforcement is continuing to grow nationwide, and the ratio is estimated to be a little bit more than 3-1. The sustained growth of these services has brought about a reliance on the availability and visibility of these services in our communities. And along with that, it brings some assumed authorities, and the potential for abuse of that authority can bring with it concerns by the public and by law enforcement and businesses as it comes to certain things like protection of people's rights and abilities in situations where they might be detained or protection of their private information. These concerns are shared by the industry as they look to support a more professional role that they have in the community that serves to help the public as well as law enforcement efforts. In regards to our budget circumstance, our organizational chart is fairly succinct. It is myself as well as one part-time employee, a half-time position. We have not been asked by the governor to calculate any reduction in what is proposed in the budget, and we don't have, as a general fund agency, we don't have any indirect costs or chargebacks or billings from the Attorney General's office. We do not have any automobiles. We have no decision to engage in rulemaking. And we do not have any pending lawsuits.
Director Ullman, how come you didn't respond to our letter the way we asked you to with either some written form of communication or whatever, like the other agencies, some documentation?
It was my understanding, Mr. Chairman, that that there was a letter that was directed to the speaker and to the chairs of the various fiscal committees from MMB Commissioner Showalter that explained that there was information available through the biennial budget system. I'd certainly be happy to try to get more particular information drawn out from those sources if you'd like.
That'd be great. I didn't like that letter that we got. It seemed like it's rather snobbish, like telling you there's the internet, go get it. And I think each agency is themselves in a precarious position when they're asked for ways to defend their budget and don't furnish it and make us look for it. And making us look for the information also makes us look for the cuts. So I would think it would behoove each agency to respond to the request in the way it was presented. That is just my personal opinion. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I can appreciate that response.
Any members... was that the end of your presentation? I'm sorry.
That is the end of my overview. If others have questions in regards to particular budget matters, I'd be happy to try to respond to that.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Chair Cornish. Looking at your budget, there's no net increase, not even a base increase. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct.
So that's a
Representative Gauthier.
So that's a 0.4% cut, actually.
Director Ullman?
Mr. Chairman?
I'm just looking at your data here, so that's
Mr.
what it
Boynton.
Says.
Mr. Chairman.
Me, could you repeat the question?
Representative Guthrie?
No increase in base is actually a 0.4% decrease or cut because you didn't get a base bump.
What? Mr. Boynton?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, the base budget for fiscal year 11 was the basis of the fiscal year 12 and 13 request, right. And there hasn't been any increases whatsoever.
Thank you.
Members, any questions? It would be good if you would get us that information, because what you force us to do is scribbling while you talk, and it's very unprofessional results. We have to recall from memory, especially people of me are approaching 60. So if you could if you could get us that information, it would be much appreciated, and then I could disseminate it to the members here. So any questions from members? If not, we will adjourn the meeting.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you very much. Sorry about that.